But let's see what the Yavitz is going to say, which we'll hold off till the end. Oh, I forgot to bring the gift. Anyways, that's question number one. What's the greatest miracle that's happened in the history of the world? That's question number one. Question number two. We read in last week's parsha, Tazria Metzora. We read right in the beginning of the parsha, tells us about what happens when a woman gives birth to a boy, gives birth to a girl, and after they give birth, there's a period of tara, followed by a period of tuma. There's a tumas leda that occurs. For a boy, it's 1 week. For a girl, it's 2 weeks. And the question is, what's going on here? Why is there tuma when a woman gives birth? We understand tuma in the context of death. That's really where tuma comes. Tuma is really avia vosa tuma is death. Is death itself is coming to contact with a dead body. We understand tuma that a person wastes seed because there's potential life there. There's tuma there. Tumas keri. We understand that, but here it is—the ultimate expression of life—and yet there's tuma that follows. Why? Why is it tuma? This is a question that everyone is bothered by. Why is it tumas leda? Another question from last week's parsha. We'll get to Achrimos Kedoshim. Last week's parsha, one of the most beautiful Divrei Torahs of the Eish Kodesh. Who is the Eish Kodesh? Remember? Pizetz the Rebbe. Where did he live?
Poland.
Poland, close. Good. Piazetsna, good. Where else? Where did we talk about him? In Warsaw. Warsaw Ghetto. He's the Rebbe in the Warsaw Ghetto. Okay? His writings, the Eish Kodesh, this Sefer, the Kisvei Yad, the writings of the Sefer, was found buried under the Warsaw Ghetto, together with the writings of Emanuel Ringelblum, who is the head of the Onik Shabbos, the archives that were kept, the diaries that were kept, so the Rebbe and all these different Torahs, stuff that he gave over in the Warsaw Ghetto. So one of the most unbelievable Divrei Torahs that he said over from this was past week's parsha. And the first time I heard this Divrei Torah was actually from Rabbi Miller, Rosh Kollel, who's in absentia, will be back next year. The Rebbe asked as follows. The Pasuk says, this he gave over in Tovshin Aleph. Okay? Tazria comes after what again? Tazria Mitzora, says the Rebbe, Parshas Mitzora, Ki Savo El Eretz Kinan, Benasati Nega Tzaraz, Veveis Eretz Echuzaschem, Perish Rashi, Besur Hilachem, Befishe Etminu Amarayim, Atmoniot Shel Zav, Vaidei Hanega Nuta Tzavayis Umotza'an. The Pasuk says that you're going to come into Eretz Kinan, you come into Eretz Israel, and you're going to find a Nega in your house. Okay? Says Rashi, this is actually good news. It's great news. You know why it's great news? Because when you pick away at that nega on the house, what did they find behind it?
Treasure.
They found the treasure behind the nega. The house is closed off for 7 days, then they pick away at the nega, and behind it is a treasure. And this is how they found the treasures that were hidden by the earlier inhabitants that hid treasures in the homes. I don't think I've told you the story in Poland of Toivy. You saw the movie Escape from Sobibor. Okay, some of you saw the movie Escape from Sobibor. So there's a person, Toivy. He's in the movie. He's one of the characters in the movie. He's one of the boys that tells... he's in the movie. Toivy Black. He's actually alive today. He lives in Santa Barbara, California. We met him a few years ago when we went with Yeshiva. We came to Maidanek, and a guy came over and said, are you with the Eish HaTorah group? We said, no, Torah Shai. He goes, I'm Toivy Blatt. We just had finished watching Escape from Sobibor, and then we come off the bus, and there's Toivy Blatt from the movie there, and he tells us this whole story. It was unbelievable. So this man, Toivy Blatt, he actually was a town of Izbica. And whatever, a long story that after he escaped from Sobibor, he went back to his hometown. And he goes back to his house. And he goes into the house, knocks on the door, and the people there go and see him, they recognize him, and they say, there's nothing, we bought the house from somebody else. We didn't take the house from you. Someone else came here, took the house, and we bought it from them. And nothing is the way it was. He's like, okay, you mind if I just, I'm not making any claims on my house, I just want to come in and see. So he comes in and he looks, and everything's exactly the way he left it, the way he remembered. Every couch was in that place, every picture was exactly the way, everything exactly as his family had left. So he says to the owners, he says, it's too bad that you're right, nothing's the way it was before, because my parents actually hid all sorts of valuables in the couches and in the walls and in different things, and I see really it's nothing the way it used to be. Thanks anyways. And he walks out, he comes back a year later, the house is gone. The people had torn apart the house looking for the treasures, which weren't. That was his way of getting it on the come. But the Jewish people, when they tore away at the walls, they had a treasure there. Had a treasure. So listen to the kasha of the Pinzatz and the Rebbe. Unbelievable question. Maybe someone's heard this before. Has anyone heard this before? Anyone heard this about Torah before? Been here for already a year. Torah Pazirim is already passed. No one's heard this before? Anyone want to take a stab at what the question? The most famous question on this pasuk. Yeah.
Why would the Torah have the reward on the church?
Okay. All right. Let's maybe twist it, turn it on its head.
Why have to wait 7 days?
Oh. Why is there a tumah here? Why wait 7 days of tumah if it's a besura tova, if it's a good news for the Jewish people? You know, it's a way to find the treasure. So why go through this whole ceremony of tumah if there's good behind it? That's the question he asks. Beautiful. Why did they close the house off for 7 days and only then remove the stones and find the treasure? They saw the nega, it's good news. They know the treasure is there. So listen to what the Rebbe says. He says, the truth is we have no idea what the Torah and its mitzvos, what the intentions are. But perhaps, maybe what the Torah is trying to hint us is the following. Because we know that whatever Hashem does for us is for the good. Hashem does for us is always for the good. Kol man dovid rachmano l'tavavid. However, we can understand even sometimes that something bad happens to us, chas v'shalom, but it's a wake-up call. A wake-up call for us to realize that you have to get serious about life. I have to do tshuva. I have to change my ways. A person loses his business. A person loses a job. Chas v'shalom, he has an illness. He has to, like, what's going on? He has to look into the way he lives his life. He says, however, what happens when a Kadosh Baruch Hu does stuff to us that seems to distance us from him? What could be the good in that? Kadosh Baruch Hu, and he's saying, look what's going on now. We can't down with a minion. The mikvos are closed. All the yeshivos closed down. No tinokos from Beis Rabin learning Torah. Is it possible that that could be for our benefit? Kadosh Baruch Hu seems to be pushing us away, closing all the opportunities of spiritual growth. Could that be for our benefit? Could there be something good behind it? And that's it, what the Torah is coming to teach us. That even when there's a period of 7 days of tumah, when there's a period of distance, behind the tumah, behind what seems to be distance from us and God, behind that there could be a treasure. That's what the Torah is teaching. And when Rabbi Miller said this to our Torah 20 years ago when I was in the Gris Kola, he said, the Rebbe's telling us that the Holocaust is this terrible time of Tumah, but behind that Tumah is a treasure. And almost every year Tazria Mitzvah comes out between Yom HaShoah and Yom HaTzmud, Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaTzmud. And there's a treasure behind it. The treasure, whether it makes up for the Tumah of the death for the 6 million of the Holocaust, time will tell. But the treasure that lay behind the Holocaust was the state of Israel. Back to our question, why is there a Tumas Leida, if it's there's a birth, why is there a Tumah when there's a given life to the world? Why should there be Tumah there? So perhaps the flip. That even when there's a birth of a child, would one at all hesitate to rejoice even when there's some Tumah that goes along with it? Would we hold back? This is what Rav Yaakov Meir Chalap, this is what the shot that he gave. He said, just even if there's Tumah that comes along with the birth of something great, we wouldn't hesitate to celebrate. Okay, so there's some Tumah that came along. There's a child here. There's a child here. Yeah, it could be that even in the birth of the state of Israel, there was some Tumah that went along with it. And even on Yom HaTzma'ut, such an amazing holiday, one can travel to Parts Yerushalayim and see things that don't seem right. That there's some, this isn't what's supposed to be. This isn't what we're supposed to be celebrating. Hayitachen that someone would go there and then continue to party like that? Someone from our yeshiva? Someone who was in Poland just a month ago would just continue and to participate in that Tumah? It's impossible to fathom. But even if that's going on over there, it doesn't mitigate our celebration of the birth of something amazing. If you may recall, again, I don't remember which bus heard this or didn't hear it. Maybe both buses did. The Kohanim certainly didn't hear it. But we mentioned the Kloisenberger Rebbe. Kloisenberger Rebbe was a descendant of Reb Chaim of Tzanz. Kloisenberger Rebbe, the Kloisenberger Tzanz, he was the symbol of the Sheiris HaPleita, the remnants of those who survived the Holocaust. He was Rebbe before he went in. He was in Auschwitz. From Auschwitz for Birkenau, he was sent back to Warsaw to be part of a camp that was trying to remove the rubble of the Warsaw ghetto. The Warsaw destruction in Warsaw, he was shot in his arm. He lost his wife and 11 children in the Holocaust. But his emuna was unscathed. His belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu was unscathed, and he stayed behind in the DP camps, even though he could have left at any time he wanted. He stayed behind DP camps as long as there are people who need physical strength. I must stay behind. And he stayed behind. Eventually he comes to America. Now there's a book, one of the amazing books, since I think I may have lent it out with somebody. Now's a good time. Any other books that I lent out, you can return them. On my desk, I don't have to say anything, just put it back on the desk. But did I give anybody the Rabbi Riskin's book? Okay, good. Great book, huh?
Yeah, it's good.
Awesome. So Riskin wrote a book, Stories I Tell My Grandchild, and I forgot the exact title. But it's basically 100 stories from his life. Each one is a winner, and some big winners, I'm going to share 3 of them. There's time. First story. From Rabbi Riskin. The title of this chapter is called My First Lesson in Zionism. He went in the Bronx. The Kloisenberger Rebbe had settled in the Bronx. This is 1952 in the Bronx. Rabbi Riskin is a little guy. He's not grown. He hasn't grown that much taller, but he's now Rabbi Riskin. But he was before Bar Mitzvah, and he decided he wanted to daven by the Hasidim, the Kloisenberger Hasidim. And he gets permission from his parents, and he goes to daven there, and it's Parshas Kisavo. And this is a story, by the way, that's very meaningful to me, because Rav Benny Eisner would tell this story almost every year on Yom Kippur, this story. But without the last part of the story, which I saw in Rabbi Riskin's book. Rabbi Riskin was there. He was there when this happened. So the Lady Kisavo, what's unique about Parshas Kisavo? Similar to Tochacha. Excellent. Tochacha is in Kisavo. So how do we relate to Tochacha? What are we doing with relating to Tochacha? Fast and quietly. Fast and quietly. So the guy starts to read the Kriyas Torah of the Tochacha fast and quietly. And the Rebbe starts to scream in Yiddish louder. How does that translate to English? Louder. In Yiddish, what is it? Huh? What? I can't hear you. Anyways, he says louder. He says louder to them. He says louder to the... So the Bakriya is like, you know, what do you mean louder? Like, you know, maybe he wasn't talking to somebody else. I don't know. So he just continues reading slow and fast. I'm sorry, fast and quietly. So he says, louder, louder. And the Valkyrie stops. And he looks at the Rebbe, and the Rebbe says, say it louder. Say the Kriyas Torah louder. So he started continuing going again, quickly and quietly. And he says, did you hear what I said? Louder, louder. He says, why do we say it quietly and fast? Because Kilu, we don't want it to happen. We want to just get through it. Let's not say it too loud that to bring ourselves like an ayin hara that's going to happen. But we have nothing to fear, because all these things happened to us already. It happened. It's in the past. It already happened to us. So let a Kadosh Baruch Hu hear what happened to us. There's no problem. There's no problem here. Let him say the curses loud, because they happened already. What hasn't happened yet is the brachos that follow. So we passed that. And then afterwards, he got up to speak at the end of shul. He gets up to speak again, and he says, "We've read the curses. They've happened to us. Now it's time for the brachos to happen." And they're only going to happen in Eretz Yisrael. As the Torah says, the parsha that follows right after the next parsha, right after Kisavo, is what? You asked this about a year ago, around this time. What parsha follows Kisavo? Yitzavim, okay. You can get it to Torah Shraga. One guy. Okay. Vayoki avo alecha kol dvirma ilo bracha v'kola ashen asadi l'vanecha v'hashivo selo avecha kol kol agayim asher yiduch ha-shem l'kecha shama v'shavta l'shem l'kecha v'shamat l'kolo v'sham ha-shem l'kecha shvuzcha im yedacha mitzei ha-shamayim v'sham ikavetzcha v'hivircha ha-shem l'kecha el oretz asher yishu ha-masecha. Immediately what follows the Tochacha is the parasha of returning to Eretz Yisrael, the parasha of Tshuva. Of return in both senses, in the physical sense and the spiritual sense. That's what follows. So the Rebbe says, Kloisenberger Rebbe said, he said, everybody, the bracha is going to come, but it's only going to come to Eretz Yisrael. It's not going to come in America. So we're packing our bags for the last time, and we're going to Eretz Yisrael. And that's what he did. Kloisenberger Rebbe went to Eretz Yisrael a few years later. He went with his community, and he set up community here at Sons, in the Tanya, and he fulfilled the promise that he made to himself after he was shot in the arm by the Nazis, and he couldn't go to an infirmary because he'd be taken away. He had to try to heal himself. He took a leaf off a tree and then tied a branch around his arm, and he healed himself. He made a promise that if he survived, he's going to build a hospital that's going to be open to any person in the world. And it's going to be run off via Torah. And that's what he built. Laniano Hospital, Sans Laniano Hospital in Netanya. He raised money, he built it. He felt now that we can engage in the most important mitzvah in the world, and that's saving people's lives. And that's what he did. Came to Eretz Yisrael. This is the place of bracha. It's only going to come from here. We were in Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin. We spoke about Rabbi Meir Shapiro, if you recall. Spoke about him as the one who founded the Daf Yomi. Rabbi Rudolf gave a very nice shiur Kiddush Hashem there. And truth is, I usually tell the story then, but I didn't tell it then. I don't think I told it then. So I'd like to share with you now, it's another Rabbi Rissen story. Rabbi Rissen came to visit Rebbetzin Herzog. Rebbetzin Herzog at the time was the almana of the chief rabbi Herzog, the first chief rabbi of the modern state of Israel. And when he came to visit her, she said, Rabbi Rissen, I want to show you something. And she took out a Gemara Pesachim. She says, you see this Gemara? This Gemara was handed to my husband by someone from the U.S. State Department. It was found amongst Hitler's personal items in one of his bunkers. When the Americans liberated Berlin, this is one of the things they found amongst his personal items, Mesechas Sachin. And they didn't know what to do with it. They felt that maybe the most appropriate thing is to give it to the chief rabbi of Israel. And that's how he got this Gemara. The Rishon was like, this is crazy, it's unbelievable. What was Hitler doing with Mesechus Pesachim? Did he have any clue that Mesechus Pesachim represents the Mesechus that talks about the redemption of the Jewish people? What we know for sure is that he was trying to destroy the Jews together with the Talmud, together with any remnants of Jewish learning, of Jewish life. That we know for sure. What he was doing with that in the bunker, we don't know. But there's something really amazing. And a number of years ago, we actually, when we went with the yeshiva, we went to Berlin. We flew in and out of Berlin, and we drove to Poland from Berlin. And on the last day that we were in Berlin, we went to this museum, which is built right near Hitler's bunker. It's a memorial. It's not really a museum, it's a memorial for the Holocaust. And it was built by this architect, Peter Eisenman. And has anyone been to this memorial in Berlin? So the memorial in Berlin is basically, it's rows and rows of tombstones on different levels. And you can walk like, almost the tombstones swallow you up. And it just looks like an endless sea of tombstones. And the number, if you go look at the brochure of about this memorial, the number of tombstones in this memorial is actually 2,711. And they asked Peter Eisenman, why did you choose this number? And he said, that's just the number that worked out in the design of this monument. That's the area we could fit in, and that's how it worked out. It's arbitrary. But what's so interesting is that number of pages in the Talmud Bavli is 2,711. The memorial is I don't know, 200 yards from Hitler's bunker. We went to Hitler's bunker, we stood over where Hitler's bunker was, we daven mincha there, we danced there, and you can see this memorial just, you know, from where Hitler's bunker stood. This memorial, again, corresponds to the page of the Talmud. Hitler tried to destroy the Talmud. He tried to destroy the Jewish people. And ironically, the memorial that's built is exactly the numbers of pages of the Talmud, which is very much alive. Rav Meir Shapiro's dream is very much alive today. Some of you went to the Siyum HaShas. Some of the rest of you should have gone to Siyum HaShas. Maybe you'll be at the next one. Maybe you'll be of the Messiahim one day, Mitzvah Shas. But it's very much alive. And if it's going to remain alive, it's really up to us. Some of you know I went recently back to Poland. I took a group actually from Antwerp. And one of the last things that I left them with was actually a story from Rabbi Shlomo Kalibach, that he was in Antwerp once, and he was in there's a church to cover Stiebel in Antwerp. He was in that shul. And he was looking at the Svarim on the Svarim Shank. And he notices a Sefer, almost everything he already has, he's been through. And then he notices a Sefer that's very unusual, he's never seen anything like this before. He takes the Sefer out and looks at it, opens the Sefer, doesn't recognize the name of the author. And it's a Sefer on Meseches Kelim, okay, which is in Seder. Seder, this has an answer. Any question? Huh? Taros, thank you. Seder Taros. Okay, there are many great Talmid Chachamim that have not been through Seder Taros. Okay, Meseches Kelim is 30 Prakim and Meseches Taros. It's one of those things that's less like when they have learned Mishnayos Lilu Nishma with somebody. So Meseches Kelim is like the last thing taken. Okay. So this Meseches Kelim, there's one question in Meseches Kelim, and the author gives 137 answers. There's one kash in Meseches Kelim, and Reb Shlomo he's amazed at this sefer. This guy he's reading is this guy is sholeit. He has the entire shas in his fingertips. And he's going through, he says, you know, let me take something from this. Let me take the kasha and a couple of the answers. He's going through the sefer. And he gets someone walks over to him, he says, you like that sefer? He says, yeah. Wow, it's an amazing sefer. Who is this person? He goes, that person, the one who wrote the sefer, is actually my uncle. But you know, that my uncle, he was a very wealthy businessman, lived in Krakow. He wasn't a known Talmid Chacham. He wasn't a rabbi, he was a regular business person, very successful, but was osik in Torah in a very serious way, as you can see. He knew everything. And we were deported. Eventually we met up again in Birkenau. In the same barracks. We were in the same barracks in Birkenau. My uncle and I. And one night he calls me over. And he says, my dear nephew, I'm not a Navi, but I have a feeling that by tomorrow morning, they're going to take me away. I have no strength left. And that means you're going to be the last remaining member of our family of over 100 people. But I want to tell you something. Since I've been here in Birkenau, I've not stopped learning for a second. You know that I know all of Shas Baal Peh. And I've been saying over Mesechtos since I came into this place. I've been saying over the Gemara. So, according to my calculations, I'm just about to start Mesechtos Moed Katan. By tomorrow morning, I'll probably be up to Daf Zayin. So I want you to continue and finish the Mesechta for me. That's what I asked of you. Finish himself. And the next morning, he left the roll call, and he never saw him again. I finished the Sefer, and I published the Sefer. One of our jobs is to finish to be Messiahim, Mesechtos, Sfarim, to do mitzvos, to do chasadim. The 6 million couldn't finish. 6 million couldn't do. 6 million couldn't live in Eretz Yisrael. And that's our job. We have this, we carry this with us. And we heard from Yoni Fried's father, this is the burden that we carry with us. We have to replace what was lost. We have to replace what was lost. That's our job. Now, there's an amazing thing that happened this year. In the census that was recently released, a few weeks ago, 6 million Jews are living here in the state of Israel. 6 million Jews are living here in the state of Israel. Why is that significant? Helps you understand why, when we go on the trams in Jerusalem, why you feel like you're in one of the cattle car lunch. Right? How crowded they are. And here you have to pay for it also. No, that's not why. The reason is because we finally got to a number where we've replaced 6 million. We replaced the 6 million. There are now 6 million Jews living here. You've heard the number on Yom Zikaron. You heard the number 25,785, something like that? 23,000 is the number of soldiers, and another 2,490 victims of terror. 2,490 victims of terror since 1860 have been killed in Eretz Yisrael. 2,490. Now, when I was in Poland on this last trip, I traveled there. I arrived in Warsaw, and the group was meeting me in Warsaw, flying from Antwerp. And I was waiting there. This guy, Jewish guy, looked pretty Jewish. Comes over to me. And he starts talking to me. What are you doing here? He's here to daven by certain kfarim, skulos, certain kfarim. So, I remember time meeting a group. Where are you from? Eretz Yisrael. And he starts getting into a whole argument with me about Eretz Yisrael, about the state of Israel. And he says to me, you know, we were better off before the state of Israel. I'm looking at him like, we're in Warsaw. There are no Jews here. And you can tell me that we were better off beforehand? Are you serious? He says, yeah, of course we were better off before. Zionism is brought about all of this, all these troubles. Is it any better for you now? I said, yeah, it is. It's much better. You know, I said, you know, next week is Yom Zikaron. 2,490 Jews have been killed in Israel since 1860 till today, 2000. In 150 years, 2,500 Jews have been killed. So do the math. Do 6 years, September 1st, 1939. Do till September 1st, 1945. 6 years. Do the math. Get to 6 million. How many Jews a day? One day. 2,500. It's even more than 2,500 in one day in Eastern Europe in those 6 years. One day, in 150 years in Israel. It's dangerous here. One day in Eastern Europe. They killed more Jews. Forget about during the years of 41 to 45 or 42 when they opened the Operation Reinhardt camps. Tens of thousands a day. Split it over 6 years, it's more than 150 years of the state of Israel. I said, is it possible after losing 6 million Jews, is it possible that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the benevolent God, can create a state that is worse for the Jewish people? Is it possible? Could you believe in such a God? Could you believe in such a God that after losing 6 million, the Jewish people are at the lowest state that we've been in our history? That then to create something that's called a Maisa Satan, it's even worse off just to fool the Jewish people, to trick us to see if we believe in God or not? And that Maisa Satan is still around 65 years later, still going on, we're still being fooled? Is that Hayitachem? Does that make sense? Now the Jews who believe that, and they have to hand it to them, they're mamish, unbelievable maminim. Their emunah is much stronger than mine. I couldn't have such emunah. I couldn't have it. But their concept of God is so foreign to me. My concept of God, the way I was raised and the way I was taught from my Rabbeim, and is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves the Jewish people. Had the Holocaust happened? I don't know. But there's a treasure behind it. There's some good that came out of it. Does it replace 6 million? No. But maybe we're on the way. Maybe we're on our way. We have 6 million Jews here. Is there tumah here? Is there things that we shouldn't participate in Eretz Yisrael? Yes, there are things. It doesn't mitigate our celebration of Yom HaTzimut. It doesn't mitigate our celebration of this wonderful birth of a rebirth of a nation. Unprecedented in any history. In any history that a nation would be exiled for 2,000 years and to come back to that nation. It's never happened before. No other nation can make such a claim. To come back to their nation according to the Torah. And the Torah said it's going to happen. The Torah said it's going to happen. We see the fulfillment of all the nevuos in our day. Oh, has it been completed yet? No. It's part of his kima, little by little, it's being completed. But that we shouldn't rejoice, shouldn't jump out of our skin in celebration. One of the heroes of the Warsaw Ghetto was a man by the name of Dr. Hillel Seidman. He was a member of the Agudas Yisrael. He was actually part of the Judenrat, and he did a tremendous amount to save Jewish people. I mentioned, I don't know if you remember, I called him, he was the one who wrote about the Gerach Hasidim, who built bunkers and studied Torah of the Mesiris Nefesh, and he took care of them. He made sure that they got food, even though they didn't have the certificates to get rations. He made sure that they were taken care of. And he mamsh envied the Mesiris Nefesh to study Torah in the middle of the Warsaw Ghetto, as if nothing was going on up above. He came to Eretz Yisrael for the first Yom HaTzimut. He was living in New York at the time. Came with his wife to Eretz Yisrael to see the celebrations of the first Yom HaTzimut, 1949. And he's walking through the streets of Yerushalayim, and who does he see? He sees the Tzaddik of Yerushalayim, Rav Aryeh Levin, dancing with other boys in the street, like young men in the street, some religious, some non-religious. And he's like, Aryeh Levin, Tzaddik Yerushalayim? He's Rebbe. He's like surprised to see him. And Aryeh Levin looks at Dr. Seidman, who is a well-known personality. Again, he was the secretary of the Aguda. He says, Dr. Seidman, look, we're just 3 years after the terrible destruction of the Holocaust. And here, young Jews dancing the streets in celebration of the formation of the return of the Jewish people. Is this not reason to give Shevach Odal Hashem? Should we not join in the celebration? Guys from TABC, very you know, and some of you other guys from New Jersey may have went to his hockey camp clinic, whatever it's called. There's a Rebbe there, Rabbi Suriel Malitsky. Yisrael Malitsky was here in the Kollel a number of years ago, and actually was very involved in yeshiva, gave a vah, the guys loved him, he continued. When he went back to YU, he was like our liaison for the yeshiva. He vahed into the alumni back in New York, and then he started teaching TABC. When he was in the Bris Kollel, he came to me right before Yom HaZikaron, and he said, I understand you're going to visit the grave of Sariel Birnbaum. Can I join you? I said, yeah, you can join me. He said, one second, Sariel Birnbaum, what's your connection? Sariel, oh, you have the same name. He goes, yeah, I'm named after him. Who's Sariel Birnbaum? Sariel Birnbaum actually was a Madrid here in BMT. BMT wasn't here then. He actually was in different location before he moved here to Bayer Vegan. He was a Madrich. He had been learning in Gush, and then when he was studying in university, he was a Madrich for the BMT guys. And when I was in Gush, what's now the YU office was actually a library, and it had a picture of Sariel Birnbaum. The library was dedicated in memory of Sariel Birnbaum. Now, I happen to know Sariel Birnbaum's family, which is very, very close friends of my family. They grew up together. Sariel's father grew up together with my grandparents' family in Czechoslovakia. So it was always a family connection. When I came to Israel, it was your age. I stayed by them for Shabbos. Their son, Sariel Birnbaum, tragically was killed in the Yom Kippur War. In fact, he was killed on Yud Aleph Tishrei, 1973. He was called up on Yom Kippur. He got a tzav on Yom Kippur in the middle of davening. He was davening actually in Gush at the time. And you can imagine that throughout Israel, there were people, messengers were sent to all the different shuls in Israel, and the men were told right after the davening, you have to report. Can you imagine what Ne'ilah was like? People who were here, you know, in Israel time, what Neil was like in those Bate Knesset all throughout Israel. So he was called up, and the next day in his tank he was killed. So every year, this year unfortunately I wasn't able to go, but every year when we go to yeshiva I take a group to the kever of Sariel Birnbaum. Fortunately his parents have since passed away, but they never recovered from losing their son. They have other children, Baruch Hashem, and a number of people named after Sariel. I think of it, Sariel Malitsky, how did you, growing up in Teaneck, New Jersey, what's your connection? You related? He goes, no, I'm not related at all. Happens to be my uncle was a BMT, and he was his madrich, and he had such a powerful impact on my uncle that after he passed away, I was born shortly after. You know, all the grandparents were alive. They didn't have anybody particularly they had the name after, but they felt, you know, that this Sariel Birnbaum was the appropriate name, and that's how I got the name Sariel. And we've been in contact with the family, and they used to send me gifts on my for my birthday every year. I get a gift from them. So anyway, so it's the first time he actually went to his kever. We took him to the kever, and he met Sariel's parents. It was very touching. I actually have pictures here of it. But I share this with you because of a particular story that happened years later. Not years later to this meeting, but years later after Cyril's death. Which is also connected to this place. One time, Elisha Birnbaum, Cyril's father, was driving from Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim. And on the way, he sees a guy, a trampist, a guy looking to hitch a ride. And he notices he's wearing a tan uniform of the Air Force, tall guy, and he has a yarmulke on his head. So he pulls over, and this guy gets in the car, and he starts talking to him, and he hears he has an American accent. So he asks him, how does a religious boy, American, get into the Israeli Air Force? So he said, you know, listen, I came to Israel, and I came to BMT, and I was I was learning here, and I would have a great time. I loved the tulip. I was a regular guy, and I was going back to Queens College. Then came Yom HaZikaron, and there, what they used to do was, in my school, they took us to the families of people who had lost loved ones in the war, and they took us to Har Herzl. And so I went to this particular house. They were telling me about their son. And he's, you know, not much older than I. And then it hit me. Is that here's this guy, you know, not so different than me, a little bit older, okay, but... And he gave his life for the Jewish people. What am I going to do for the Jewish people? What am I doing with my life? And I decided what I felt I could do is, I'll join the army. And so whatever, I had a high profile, and I went through one kibbutz, another, and I eventually got to the Air Force, and here I am. Wow, do you remember the name of the family you went to? I don't remember the name of the family. I remember the name of the boy. It's a very unique name. His name is Sariel. My son. Like we said in Poland, you can't have experienced that in a year in Israel, going from Yom HaShoah to Yom HaZikaron to Yom HaTzmaut, without this question nagging at you. And what am I going to do for the Jewish people? Now, doesn't mean everyone here has to go to the Israeli army tomorrow. Because there are many needs we have for the Jewish people. But you can't live your life without giving an answer to that question. What am I? Me. Nobody else. What am I doing to Jewish people? You have to answer that question. So many gave their lives. We don't need more dead Jews. We need more living Jews giving their lives to Jewish people. So here's the final story. Back to Rabbi Riskin. Rabbi Riskin comes here to Israel on a mission in 1973. And he has a whole bunch of wealthy Jews from the Upper West Side with him, goes to checks in the King David Hotel, and he sees the newspaper, and in the newspaper it says a death notice. A death notice for the son of Rabbi and Mrs. Schwartz, living on Rehov Shimoni in Yerushalayim, lost their son in Yom Kippur War. Now, why is that so significant? Because when Rabbi Riskin started being a rabbi in 1964 in Lincoln Square, they made a celebration, a farewell party for Rabbi and Mrs. Schwartz, who were making Aliyah in 1964. Now, this Rabbi Schwartz had lost his wife and his entire family in the Holocaust. Remarried, and was rebuilding his family. And he had, at the time, 1954, he had a teenage son and a son just about to be bar mitzvah. And they made aliyah, they had a farewell. He was a Talmud Chacham, and he, again, represented the rebuilding after the Holocaust. And he made aliyah. And in 1967, his oldest son was one of the 600 soldiers, Israeli soldiers, that were killed in battle in 1967. And in 1973, his last remaining child from two families, his whole future in this world was taken from him. Rabbi Riskin felt, I have to go pay a Shiva call. This is unprecedented. He left his group and he ran from the hotel, he ran to pay a Shiva call. It was a packed house, people were just standing room only, and it was total silence. You know the halacha is that the morning is supposed to start the conversation. It's very awkward sometimes, but that's halacha. Because we can't really console somebody who after loss. And in this situation, he lost his family in the Holocaust, and now in Eretz Yisrael, he loses another two sons. That's it, nothing left. What could people possibly say? There's no comfort. So Riskin, he's there almost an hour, and he has his whole group with him, you know, back in the hotel, and he has to get back. So he doesn't think that these people remember him. He was like a new rabbi when they moved out. And he just goes up and he says, Hamokom Yinachem Yisrael Mishrocha B'Sof Shavu Lizim Shalayim. The man looks up and says, Rabbi Riskin. He says, yes. He says, Rabbi Riskin, I want to ask you something. Why do we say Hamokom Yinachem Yisrael? Why do we choose the kinui, the reference to God of Hamokom, and not Hashem, Yinachem Yisrael? Why Hamokom? Said, good question. Why Dafka Hamakom in this place, this time? So the rabbi said to him, you know, I never understood until now. He says, you know, when I lost my entire family in the Holocaust, there was no comfort. They died in Europe in a place that we had no connection, real connection to. And there was no being comforted. But now, I was zoche to give two holy sons to the Holy Land. Hamakom Yinachem Yisrael. Yes, it's a reference to Hashem, but it's also Hamakom, this place. They gave their lives for the Holy Land. To give their lives to this place. Hamakom, now I have a nechama. These two sons, they died in vain. They died for a reason. They died for a purpose. They died for a goal. They died for us. Giving their lives so we can be here. We're full of Torah here. So this is my comfort. Eretz Yisrael is our comfort. Friends, that Rabbi Yaakov Emden says, the Yavit says, the greatest miracle that has happened in the history of the Jewish people is the fact that we are still here. Not only are we still here, but we're here in Eretz Yisrael, we're here in a Beis Medrash, learning Shas, learning the Torah, that all throughout our entire existence, people have been trying to destroy time and time again. There is no greater miracle in the world than us being here in Eretz Yisrael learning Torah. And we have the privilege to be a part of it. We are living that miracle. We are that miracle. Let's dedicate ourselves to Jewish people. Have you?
Thank you. Fantastic.